and welcome to the Wokus Roundtable Podcast. We're podcasting tonight with Daryl Gregory in Pennsylvania.
Howdy.
And Tim Akers in Chicago.
Howdy.
And I thought I'd kick off the discussion tonight, again, thanks to technical difficulties, talking a little bit about mixing genres and how that both Tim and Daryl have done that variously in their novels and occasionally short stories. So, Daryl?
Oh, I have to go first again?
Yes.
Okay. All right, fine. Well, as I was saying, we were talking about my first novel, Pandemonium, which came out, I think, in 2008. And that's a novel where I wrote it deliberately to be as unmarketable as possible. It's a genre novel where the characters don't know what genre they're in, and neither do the readers, and neither did I, obviously, for a long period. And I actually still, if somebody calls that book a fantasy, I start arguing with him and telling them that it's science fiction. And if they call it science fiction, I just slap them around. So, and that's a book about where there's a sort of a epidemic of people being possessed by these things they call demons. That's been happening for 40 years, where people just, you know, as people will do regularly, seem to get possessed by some other personality, and no one knows whether this is these are like real demons or whether this is a neurological issue, a psychological problem, and the main character doesn't know either. He's got a demon locked inside him, and he's trying to see a psychologist and seeing a neuroscientist, and eventually. As I was telling these folks earlier, a bald Catholic schismatic priest who looks a lot like Sinead O'Connor, who, by the way, there's all this weird background material about these weird Catholic splinter groups. And I went on in some detail, and then I had to explain to people that I made up none of it. It's all Sinead O'Connor's real religious background. And she's a crazy woman, but I love her, and I kind of have a crush on her.
So, really?
Yeah. Let's just come out and say it. Natalie Portman, Winona Ryder, and Sinead O'Connor. Let's just say that right now and get it out in the open.
As long as you can get that off your chest.
Yeah. And each of them will be showing up in each of my books at some point. Yeah, so that's sort of where I came from. And I figure when you're writing a novel that you don't think will ever be published, you might as well just write whatever you want. And I read all types of things, and I didn't know why I had to pick one genre over another anyways. And I think most genre readers, I mean, I don't think they're deciding a lot. I mean, maybe there are people in one hardcore group or another, but it seems like people read all over the map. Even Tim's books, and that's called a segue into Tim's.
I will point out that the top two genre fantasy science fiction books this week on PW's top 10 are Game of Thrones and the new Jack Campbell Lost Fleet book. So there are plenty of people that are reading pure fantasy and pure science fiction still. It's just none of them come to conventions, I don't think.
Look at Game of Thrones. I mean, there's hardly any magic in it.
It's a kind of low magic universe, actually.
Well, it's a low magic universe, except it starts off with zombies, and you've got, you know, zombies in the middle of it. I mean, it starts off as a very low magic universe that slowly builds into a very high magic universe. By the time you get to book 25, which is where we are currently by any normal count.
By normal page count.
Yeah. You've got, you know, some fairly significant magic events going on. Anyway, I'm not here to pimp George R. R. Martin.
You're here to pimp yourself.
Doesn't need my voice. So my first series was actually kind of how I usually explain it is it's fantasy, but it's fantasy that's based on Victorian America as opposed to medieval England or Lancelot era France. It didn't work all that well because I don't think anybody's ever said to me, this is based on clearly sort of cowboy fantasy. Because when you think of cowboy fantasy, you think of cowboys, and that's really not how it came out at all. I didn't really go into it with any sort of intention as far as it being steampunk or I'm going to say it weird.
Told you.
That's that's kind of how it ended up. I was telling the story earlier. The first time that anybody clearly defined my book for me was at World Fantasy Con in Calgary. And I was trying to explain to a couple of booksellers what the book was about, and I was doing an absolutely horrible job. I mean, it was my second convention, and I was terribly, terribly drunk, surprisingly enough. And I was trying to explain this book, and my editor, Mark Newton of Solaris Books, sort of stopped me, and he leaned over in his lovely British voice and said, "Steampunk thriller." And that kind of is how I've been explaining that series since then. I really thought of it more as a kind of noir, cog-based fantasy, but steampunk thriller sells better, so that's what I've been calling it. The other series that I write has Ava Forge. She's the last paladin of a dead god.
Another great catchphrase. This is what I want to learn from Tim, is how to come up with these phrases so I can sell books.
I don't know. They come out of nowhere. It's just, if it does sound really nice, it's a very satisfying phrase.
I think Lou Anders bought it based solely on that phrase, right? I mean, he just heard that and it's like he was sold.
I did sell the book on essentially a long email, and that was the first line. I came to him and I said, you know what? I don't want to write a book that has anything to do with any specific genre. I want to write whatever I want to write. I want to write a book about a paladin who's, the last paladin of a dead god. I want her to be a kind of a badass. I want to write sort of a noirish urban fantasy with a lot of epic fantasy in there. And I want to put it in a city, and I want there to be, these punks that are wandering around with switchblades. And I want there to be zombies with jetpacks. Zombies with jetpacks.
He's not lying, actually.
Is there any way that I could have like machine guns in that? And he's like, yeah, just write what you want to write, he sold. Here's your advance. Write me something that sounds like that. And I kind of did. I mean, it took me a little while to get like my head around what I wanted the book to be, because like the very early drafts were much more traditional fantasy, and it wasn't until probably my third strike at the thing that I kind of found the groove. That eventually became The Horns of Ruin. That entire book is actually based on a Star Trek The Next Generation issue or episode that was in XKCD this week. So that's going to date this thing. But it's the one where the people talk in metaphor. And
Darmok.
Yes, Darmok. Mm. I heard that and I was like, wow, what if you had a magic system that was based on story? How would that work out? The first time I tried to work that out was for a game called Unknown Armies. I used to write for role-playing games. And I submitted this entire thing of the way that magic worked in Unknown Armies is everyone was based on an archetype. You could become the girl you could never get, or you could become the aspect of destruction. They're just sort of, any archetype that you could come up with, you could potentially become the ideal representation of that. That would give you magical powers. And I tried to create the storyteller, but they didn't like my idea, so I didn't buy it. But I thought it was good. And eventually I wrote a book about it. So Works out.
It seems like novels give you a lot more space to play with that kind of... with all that kind of stuff. I mean, because if you were doing a short story and you wanted zombies and switchblades and jetpacks and zeppelins and paladins, it might feel a little crammed.
There's a reason I don't write short stories anymore. I mean, I came to all of my short stories with essentially novel-sized ideas. And the short stories just never worked all that well. They were never more than ideas about short stories. I don't bother with them.
I don't think that's true. But here's the thing that short stories can do better than novels, which is they can be elliptical. I feel like you can get away sometimes with a lot more because you don't have to explain, an entire. Let's say, you don't have to actually build an entire world. And if you can have the root story be something that people could follow, there seems like there's this allowance for not having to explain everything. That's awfully freeing. I don't know. I tend to like that.
Yes.
I like, and it's my job to grind the conversation to a halt. Everyone's.
Well, no, Daryl, I was just saying that you're when I read your short fiction, I feel like it has more clear genre boundaries. You know, second person present tense and Damascus and things like that. I feel like they're pretty core. Whereas all three of your novels, I'm halfway through Raising Stony Mayhall right now, and all three of the novels, they're either science fiction that reads like fantasy or fantasy that reads like science fiction, like you were saying.
Well, Devil's Alphabet is written specifically to be, I thought of it as hardcore science fiction that feels like some sort of weird magical realist novel about a small town in Tennessee.
Yeah, that ended up being science fiction, but Southern Gothic more than...
Yeah, exactly.
See, here's the thing that you might not know. We're both Southern writers. We're both, you know,
having
modern Southern writers.
South.
Having fled the South. As long as Southerners.
But I'm sort of a transplant. So, I mean, Devil's Alphabet is about being a transplant because I was raised in Chicago by Southerners, which is like being raised by wolves out there in the city. And so I always thought of myself as kind of a Southerner. An insider, outsider kind of person, because I would also go visit Tennessee and think these people are crazy. But it was also completely my heritage, and then I would get defensive when other people made fun of them because that was sort of my job.
Yeah, no one can make fun of me as well as me. Come on.
But getting back to Karen's point, and back to me, Tim.
God, sorry, I apologize.
It is true that with some stories, especially the neuroscience stories, I put on my science fiction hat and I keep it firmly tied. But there's all kinds, like in second person present tense, there's all kind of weird philosophical stuff that I was interested in sort of tagging on top of the neuroscience. But when I'm in science fiction mode, it is sort of my rule. I like my science fiction to actually – I like my science to actually make sense. So I have real trouble writing about, you know, way the heck in the future. We used to call it WTFFF, way the fuck in the far-flung future. Because I had trouble, even though I love people like Ian Banks and I read some of this stuff, I wanted all my science to actually work, or all the technology to be only like Tuesday away from working. So I would sort of set my bar on doing that kind of stuff. Mostly, and this is also a kind of laziness in that if you set your stuff – you set your stories in basically the real world. You don't have to do a lot of world building. You can just tell people, you know, in Colorado, and people, everybody knows what Colorado is.
This is true.
That's true. Yeah.
Once again, I'm just glad I could bring this conversation to you.
Well, Jim, okay, so I can follow up on that. One of the reasons that I don't write that kind of science fiction is because I really hate research. And I, like, the book I'm doing now is the first time I've done research for anything, and I include all of my school papers in that. I don't like having something that you have that you could potentially fact check against. So I like making up everything from just the ground because I find that to be a lot easier. And I have the unfortunate propensity of breathing out worlds as if, you know, they were air. I just, you know, all of the time, little ideas are coming out of my head. And if I have to try to ground those things in actual places, you know, it just kills them. So I in that way, I'm the entire opposite. I just can't do research.
Yeah. So here's the nice thing about research is that a lot of times what I find is that by restricting myself to the real world or real science, the metaphors become really clear. You know, like the neuroscience in second person, it's really a gay coming out story. It's a queer awakening story, but just happens to be about neuroscience and multiple personalities and your parents not understanding you. But it's like all by sticking to real stuff, the metaphors are sort of tucked in there for you, and you get this kind of you get a nice kind of resonance without hardly working for it. Yeah. I guess we're all just arguing for different forms of laziness, I've decided.
Laziness is awesome.
Well, and Tim, you mentioned that you've done different kinds of role-playing.
Yes.
Before the – and Were you actually DMing those kind of games, or?
Yeah. I've Daryl and I have both played role playing games since we were kids. Different games. I used to write for White Wolf Game Studios. They do Vampire, and I used to write for Wraith a lot. And I did a lot. I did stuff for various independents. There was a point in my life where I wanted to be a professional role play gaming RPG designer. And I got out of that pretty quick, just because the pay was terrible and I wasn't as good at it as I wanted to be. That sounds terrible, but I was good at it, but I wasn't like, you know, a brilliant, you know, rising star or anything. So I just sort of stepped aside from that. I still play. My wife and I are in a D&D campaign that's been going for over 20 years, 25 years.
Wow.
I met her over a game of Shadowrun. That's how I knew everything was going to be okay.
Are you like level 2000?
No, they keep resetting. You know, they keep changing. We're actually on hiatus right now because one of our people was in Turkey. So
I just got the idea for this campaign where everyone is a god.
Yes.
You know, it's like Mormons. Each of you get your own planet.
And you're a god, and you're a god, and you're a god.
You're a god.
Yeah, I know we've had the same characters running for one campaign setting for 5 years, and we are seriously starting to hit that limit.
And
it's really hard to keep a game under control at that point when everyone's becoming way too powerful.
Yeah, I know, and we have to reset every 3 or 4 years just because people get bored and kind of with the characters in themselves and with the powers and stuff. It's just good to mix it up every once in a while. So,
well, and here's a nice thing that's coming for both of you people, maybe, certainly for Karen, is that someday there'll be this magical moment when you realize they are old enough to play with you. So my game of choice was Champions, the superhero role-playing game. Love this game. Played all through college. And then after college, it was hard to find people to play with and find the time to play. But then my kids got old enough, and my college roommate, who was the best GM I'd ever had, J.R. Jenks, came to visit for my 40th birthday, and he came early, and he ran a champs game for my kids, and we're like, and then it was on like Donkey Kong. It was fantastic.
That's, you know, that's good.
Excellent. Yeah, and now my son, you know, he's like he goes off to play, but I can't even play his games now. He's playing Magic the Gathering mostly at some kind of Olympic level. And I'm just sort of stunned by the whole process.
I used to play competitive Magic. That's a real serious game. I couldn't afford it, to be quite honest.
I had to drop out of Magic just because to stay in that level, you definitely have to have some skill and some cash.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Now I spend all my time now playing World of Warcraft.
I cannot play computer games anymore because they just suck up writing energy like nobody's business. I mean, I've got Portal 2 here, and I love Portal 1, and I'm sort of the way through Portal 2, but I can't. I have to keep putting it away because it's like crack, and it seems to take up storytelling energy.
You should play World of Warcraft, dude. It doesn't take up time at all. You'll have
all this free time.
Well, yes, whenever I hear World of Warcraft people talk, it's absolutely about all their free time.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I had to get divorced, but I met my next wife online. She's great.
Yes. But no, I won't lie. I actually, Curtis and I already found this a simplified D&D gaming system called RPG Kids. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm only 6 months pregnant, and I'm already like, we'll tuck this away for later.
There was a game called Fuzzy Bunnies that was designed for 4 or 5 year olds,
mm-hmm.
Maybe a little older. I don't know. How about this tall? I'm bad with ages.
I like it on the phone. You're holding up your hand.
Yeah. It's just it was intro to role playing for really small kids. So it's a positive thing.
No, it's interesting the way that kind of cross media can really. How do you say? It seems like it can generate story ideas.
Yeah, I think that at least this generation is informed by a variety of media. When I go to a book, you know, I am as much informed about, you know, about fantasy by the video games I play, the role-playing games that I've played in the past. For Daryl, I know comic books have had a significant influence. Then I think most generations in the past were. My father-in-law is a big, big science fiction fan. And really, he only thinks of it as science fiction. He only participates in science fiction in book form. You know, he doesn't have any interest in science fiction movies, you know, marginal interest. He doesn't have any interest in any other form of science fiction. But he consumes the books like they were water. And I think that, you know, nowadays science fiction is just as much about, you know, manga and video games and anything else than it is about just the books. So I think, like, Comic-Con is an insane place, and we need to shove books into places like Comic-Con and you know, Wizard World and stuff. And if we don't, then the paper's going to get left behind because, you know, it's a tough sort of nut to crack.
Oh yeah, I went to my first Comic-Con last year, and it was just stunning. Both the number of people and the energy level and the youth level. I mean, people talk all the time about aging fandom and science fiction, but boy, it does seem to be a huge shift between the average age of someone at Worldcon versus someone at Comic-Con. It's just kind of stunning.
Yeah, and I mean, even small comics conventions are larger than Worldcon has ever been and will ever be again. I mean, the numbers just aren't there.
Actually, the thing that I remember just stunned me was there was an IEEE photo-optoelectric conference in Long Beach that was larger than Worldcon. And I mean, that seems like such an incredible niche technical specialty.
Well, especially because it was almost entirely staffed by robots. Is that?
Yeah, I don't know what the population would have been if they counted the robots.
Yeah.
But no, it was like a 15,000 person convention or conference, I should say. And I was like, we're a very small niche in the very large universe.
Well, and even when you talk about like the Hugo, how many people vote on the Hugo, honestly?
About 800 to 1,000, depending on the year.
Right. And that's deciding the best book in science fiction. And that's because they're the hardcore guys. They're the guys that are you know, very serious about it. But, you know
I feel exactly
readership rates, it's nuts. It's the numbers are weird.
Well, I feel exactly the same way about Hugo's. They don't mean anything until I win one. Then they will become very important, and I will completely.
Somebody was talking about best related work, and he goes, "Doesn't it bother you people that it seems like all your friends are getting nominated for this award year after year?" And I'm like, "No, that's the only way I hope to win one someday."
But I will say this: I mean, Tim was right. I mean, I was raised on comic books. Probably, I think that was my first reading experience, and. Yeah, and comics mix everything together, especially like the big superhero comics. I mean, you've got Fantastic Four, which is basically, science wonder stories. And you had – in the same comic, you could have Science Guy, Iron Man, and Captain America, and then a god would also be on the team. And then they would go visit Doctor Strange. I mean, there's the kind of genre mixing is kind of crazy. And I must admit that, like, in reaction to that, I do like it when in the stuff I work on, I usually try to change just one thing. I'm really interested in, like, for me, the one of the great reading experiences when I first pulled open Wild Cards by George R. Martin, since we were talking about Game of Thrones earlier, because I just love the idea that there was just one origin story for everybody, even if the origins didn't quite hold up. But I just love that idea, and so I basically stole not only that idea from Wild Cards, but also the structure for that for my first novel. All the cutscenes are basically the same cutscenes, same kind of style as was in that first Wild Cards book. And I actually got a chance to apologize and thank George R. R. Martin at a Worldcon in Montreal to explain, hi sir, I stole stuff from you.
That's okay. He can't find Tolkien to apologize to him.
I think everything's game. I mean, the novel that Karen's reading right now, Stony Mayhall, coming out in stores June 28th, is basically my anti-zombie novel. Because I looked around at all the zombie things that were coming out, and I thought, you know what? Somebody really needs to add to that. And I thought that should be me.
Brave.
But basically, I pitched it to the editor as the Unforgiven of zombie novels. Like, I saw Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood, and I thought, that's it. We're done with Westerns. I mean, there's nothing more you can say about a Western after that. And so now it's impossible to kill the zombie genre. But I decided I was going to write exactly one zombie book, do everything I wanted to do, and undermine it as much as possible, and then get the hell out of Dodge before people figured out what had happened.
What's going on?
Well, and I have to admit, I'm halfway through that, and right now it feels, unless you really, I'm not, again, it could all change at the end, but it feels like a fantasy that reads like a science fiction right now.
Yeah. Well, basically, the premise is that, like, if you're living in an impossible universe where the dead can walk again, and I'm taking classic Romero zombies like Dead, actually not disease, not Resident Evil virus-prone mutants, but actual dead people. Well, now you're living in an impossible universe, but that doesn't mean you stop thinking logically about it, or right, that you don't stop trying to figure out what's going on. And so that just becomes part of the metaphysics or physics of your universe, and you proceed from there. And so none of the fantasy stuff kicks in. I think of it as a science fiction novel where the science is that dead people can walk.
Of course, Tim, when I read Heart of Verdun, I remember when I had settled in to the plane coming back from World Fantasy, I think San Jose, and I was like, oh, I'll try this book. And when it started with the Zeppelin crash, I was like, I don't care what genre it is. This is an adventure story.
Yeah.
This is going to be awesome.
Yeah, it's, you know, the shit breaks. That's kind of my basic premise for all novels. So things happen, shit breaks. People have to unbreak it.
Well, I've violated my rule because I decided, like, you know, much like with zombies, that I looked around at all the steampunk stuff that was going on. And I thought, all right, that Zeppelin has already sailed. I'm not going to do anything with steampunk, no matter what. And then I got a chance to write this Planet of the Apes book, and I said it during the new steam age of the apes, and I've got frickin' Zeppelins and Gatling guns run by apes. I feel dirty.
That's just the soot. Don't worry, it'll wash off.
That's just the steampunk soot.
Governor, you know. Crazy.
So Tim, with having specifically sort of aimed your Verdun stories at American Victoriana instead of British Victoriana, what influence did that have?
I mean, the main thing is, like, with British Victoriana, you're talking about empire. You're talking about, ascent and there's a lot of, like, about culture and history and all this stuff. And with American Victorian era stuff, you're talking about the frontier, and you're talking about just newness and energy and a complete lack of respect for history. Part of the Verdun stuff is that essentially the city of Verdun is a city that's built on the wreckage of godhood, you know. And
another one of those beautiful catchphrases.
Yeah. If only I could, yeah. Anyway, so they're on the wreckage of this really ancient sort of powerful civilization, and they don't understand it, and so they make gods out of it. And it's a very American way of approaching that kind of thing. And it's all about the frontier. It didn't come across as much in the book as I wanted it to, but the idea that they were on the edge of something was important to the book.
Well, you definitely get the idea that they're on the edge of wilderness too, that they're sort of like this outpost almost. It feels very claustrophobic as far as outside the city. You get the feeling that like anything could be happening out there in the wilds.
Right. Yeah. Especially the fact that they're on a waterfall that is 2 miles tall. And it's only very recently that people are able to get over the waterfall and get down into the frontier land beyond that. That's kind of, and they're bringing back all this technology and stuff that no one's ever heard of. And they keep kicking over hornets' nests and gods that they don't really know are there. And, it's fun. Oh, yeah. And Dead of Eridon comes out next week, actually, a week from tonight, actually. And it's very much all about, having made mistakes in the past and having to fix them. So it's fun.
Makes sense. It's interesting. When you're talking about that, my reviewer history brain sort of seizes on that notion of frontier, because for forever, science fiction basically stood up and said, we are the literature of the frontier. But of course, with the total shutdown of the manned space program, but certainly kind of stalling out after Apollo, that's become so much less true. And it's interesting to see something that's, again, genre blending and as much fantastic as it is science fictional, saying, look, we've got a frontier over here. And Sherry Priest did something similar in, what was the steampunk western?
Bone Shaker. Yeah. Go ahead,
Josh. And I think fantasy novels gave people the frontier back too. I mean, that sense of adventure, the sense of possibility stuff. When science fiction turned inward, fantasy was still turned outward, I think that's why it's probably the dominant seller in the genre.
Well, I think the reason that steampunk is taking off as it stands now is because science fiction and science, forgive me, have lost that sense of wonder, and steampunk has taken. Has kind of, they've wound the clock back, and they've created, a future that's already happened. They've created yesterday's future that never happened, and we're having the opportunity to sort of re-experience it through these sort of fantastic eyes, through goggles that can see impossible things. I guess it's like an impossible yesterday. It's just it's a wonderfully vibrant and optimistic kind of genre, but in a lot of ways it's also sort of a dangerous nostalgia. It's a very inward looking subgenre. We keep buffing off the bits that are interesting and ignoring the bits that are all greasy and in between the cogs. So anyway,
that was the most beautiful extended steampunk metaphor. We should make sure we play this in the highlight reel, Karen.
Well, and that makes sense, because I once heard somebody describe steampunk as the past that could have given us the future that we actually wanted, as opposed to the one we ended up with now. Although, I keep trying to... I don't want to seem too miserablest here, because my word, I do love my iPhone.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
If you have a choice between Blade Runner and Star Trek, honestly, which one do you want to live in?
Right.
Come on.
Yeah.
People are so nice in Star Trek.
Exactly.
Everyone's so nice and shiny, and there's very little dirt.
So you mentioned maybe talking about process, because this is something that Daryl and I have talked about in the past.
Yeah.
We could completely change the subject here if you don't mind.
We're fine.
I think we've mined the subject so far. Daryl, talk about your process.
Okay. Well, it depends. I mean, it's a really chaotic process and I think every time I talk to another writer about the process, everybody is appalled by the other person's process. They just cannot believe anybody gets any work done at all. For me, I used to would be itching to start writing, and so I would just start writing with whatever came to mind, and then pretty soon I would just sort of run right into a brick wall. And then I decided to sort of relax a little bit and let things percolate and wait until I had sort of the ending. And so for my process, it's the beginning is tends to be this really nonlinear thing, and a lot of times it's an image or it's a strange or it's a character or it's a weird bit of scientific ephemera that pops up in some article or something, and so there's some nugget there, but then I cannot figure out what it has to do with other things, and so then it's sort of a laborious process of just filling up. The only time I actually use an analog pen and paper notebook is in the planning process of stories and novels. Once I get rolling, it's all happening on the laptop. But it's a lot of questioning myself and trying to find connections between things and inventing connections between things. And so it sort of accretes some sort of substance where I will figure out what the ending is. And if I know what the beginning is and I know what the ending is, then I have enough to write it. The middle is usually a vague, hazy process. But I'm also a really slow writer. So a lot of things are happening, especially once I get started writing, it's happening on the page in that moment. Like the outline sort of falls away. It becomes this kind of useless thing. And then so there's stuff that's happening as I write it. And so it's just not a very efficient process at all.
Mm. Yeah. I cogitate in a similar way. I do all of my thinking and muddling about with fountain pen and paper. Because I like the sound of a fountain pen on paper. It's a very satisfying sound. And I have enough OCD issues that I can hook on something like that and still function. And it's like ideas are accrete and stuff. The problem that I have is if I let myself be as slow of a writer as I could be, I would never get anything done. So I sort of make myself sort of discipline up and form a plot and sort of throw things together. I do a lot of planning before I begin writing. I plot very meticulously and then I discard it and replot. And I have the unfortunate tendency to come up with problems without having come up with solutions and then just sort of keep writing. And like my notebook is full of, okay, I'm on chapter 23. The following 8 things are not resolved. There are problems that I just sort of created as I went along. I need to figure out what the solution is. And it's funny because I tend to do a lot of my plotting the same way I did plotting for role-playing games that I was running. I just have a session going on and I'd throw something in, you know, this person shows up or whatever, and just see how the characters react. And if it threw everything else off kilter, then it did, but it was always interesting. The problem is that you end up with plot threads that you have to trim later on and it can get messy. But
so how early early or if at all does theme enter into it for you, Tim?
I don't even consider a theme. Theme comes out of That's hard to say. Theme comes out of character. I mean, I don't intentionally didactically put anything into my books as far as like, you know, thematic intent. But those things come out of characters and situations. So I don't sit down and say, okay, this is going to be a book about the ineffability of religion and the inability to, you know, grasp belief strongly. What I say is, it's going to be a book about gunfights in alleys. You know, that's essentially what's going to happen. And if that other stuff creeps in, let's be honest, my dad was a theologian. That stuff is going to creep in. You kind of have to work with it. But I don't inject it. It happens on the side.
Okay.
And that's sort of, you know, part of the process of who I am. That's just, you know, anything that I talk about for an extended period of time is going to approach those subjects anyway. So,
now, yeah, Daryl, it seems like your stuff, I don't know if it starts with the character, but it seems very character focused or very character driven.
Yeah, for me, it is. I mean, for me, the character and the voice of the character are the whole the whole trick for me. Because if I can latch onto them, then I can sort of hang on to the book. For me, the theme is an early part of the process where I, because there's usually some argument that I've been dying to make that I want to make, and like Tim and I were talking about plotting, and he's like, he was, you know, he's already expressed the philosophy of, you know, blowing shit up, and then you know, you'll find a way, you know, you'll basically put your characters at gunpoint, and they'll find a way out. You'll put them in that room, and they'll find a way out. But my problem is, I keep wanting to have them find a way out that relates to my theme. and that's like a smaller and smaller box every time. So, like in Stony Mayhall, the ending absolutely depends on the theme of the book basically being an anti-horror novel, where. And I think Devil's Alphabet is kind of, all the books are kind of anti-horror novels in that horror is about realizing the truth and then recoiling, or recoiling if I was more British. And I was raised by Southerners, so recoil is what happens when your 22 hits you in the nose. And so for me, it was very much about, look, the point of the book is not to realize the horrible truth and say, okay, these people are monsters, and you pull away and we fade back to the nice people. But it's like things get stranger and stranger and more horrible. Pus starts coming out of characters. But the whole point is that you walk toward the strangeness, and that's always been like a deliberate thing of mine, is and that's why these books in my mind really are science fiction more than fantasy, because in science fiction, the thing I always liked about it was it sort of by the end of the novel, it sort of tears apart the status quo. I mean, leaving out the Michael Crichton, you know, kind of books where the evil goo gets put down and all the people get to go back to their homes. I like the books, you know, the Arthur C. Clarke 2001. By the end of the book, you've got a space baby floating around, and everything is completely different. And by the end of the book, and Clark does this so well, I mean, end of Rendezvous with Rama, I mean, the door just gets kicked open again, not gets kicked closed. And that's really what I'm attracted to. So if I end up, if the plot is steering me toward, you know, killing the big bad, I usually... you know, I recoil and recoil against that.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way of thinking of it. I don't read a lot of horror. I mean, Jen's a big horror reader. That's never been my thing. But the idea of you know, realizing the awful truth and then recoiling from it, or recoiling from it, depending. That's interesting. So how do you deal with questions of good and evil?
I mean, oh yeah, I don't. I tend to take apart good and evil. I maybe this is a reaction growing up the way I grew up. But I really came to resent clarity.
Well, yeah,
and the black and white nature of the way I grew up, and everything was sort of expressed in metaphor, like staying on the straight and narrow, and there was, you know, the light and the dark, and I thought, man, I'm not seeing this. I mean, other people may be seeing the world this way, but as a kid, I was actually trying to see it that way, and nothing was that clear.
You can't see it when you're a kid, for God's sake. Yeah,
but for me, and then so for me, I usually operate against anything heading toward good and evil. It just for me, that's a warning sign that I've gone off track.
Yeah.
There's only different and same. Yeah. So I mean, and this is why I write kind of unsatisfying books.
but Tim, so do you feel, I mean, when you're doing your own work, do you tackle the huge existential questions?
I don't think I do. See, that's the thing. I really don't sit down and didactically try to come up with, okay, how am I going to approach? But when I say that, you know, like, that was quite loud. You couldn't hear that, but I could hear that. That thing went off on my computer, and it was very loud.
The voices in Tim's head.
Yeah, the WinZip computer notification. Do I approach
I guess from your process, looking back, have you seen yourself?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, like the Church of the Algorithm in the Veridon series, that's very clearly, you know, an attempt to figure out what religion is and how it approaches mystery. But I don't do that like intentionally. I don't sit down and say, okay, I want to create, you know, I want to intentionally create a church that is going to tear apart the idea of church, you know. because of the way that I was raised, because of, you know, like Daryl said, this mentality as a child of black and white and good and evil, and then there comes a point in your life when you realize that doesn't make any sense, and it's irrational, and you know, evidentially, clearly wrong. you spend a lot of time, I guess, at least I do, thinking about how that mentality, how that interacts with the world. And then how the world interacts with those people, how they see things. So I write about religion a lot. That's a long answer for a short question. But I write about religion as artifact and as construct. Like one of the first things when I was a really small kid, you ever read Asterix the Gaul?
Yeah.
Oh, the comic series?
Yeah. So I love Asterix the Gaul. And when I was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old, I was reading one of them, and all the time Asterix is going off about, you know, instead of swearing, he would say, "Oh, by Zeus," or, you know, whatever. And I was a kid. I didn't really like, I didn't grasp that that was him actually swearing in the name of a god that he believed in. You know, that was actually blasphemous in his mind. And I do remember the point where I was like, you know, good heavens, because I was still a child.
Good heavens.
Oh,
shit.
Dear me. You know, that is, that whole thing that I think of as mythology, that was a religion at one point. You know, that was, people seriously sacrificed and believed in this. The idea of a religion that doesn't have any adherence, but still everyone knows about, is very interesting to me. So that's in Veridon. So I think of, you know, that's the kind of thing that I approach in my work. I don't really sit down and think, oh, you know, what's good? Let's figure out what good is. Let's figure out what evil is. Let's figure out, you know, why there is no good or evil. Those are all, those questions I think are too big for the kind of things that I write. So. Though I always have been bothered by Tolkien's approach to evil. The way Tolkien presented evil was, albeit very Catholic, really a cop-out, because like the most solid examples of evil and good people becoming evil, I can think of three. I'm not really a hardcore Tolkien geek, but off the top of my head, the Palantir, Wormwood, the advisor, or Wormtongue, the advisor, mm-hmm. And then obviously the Ring. Those are all outside external influences that caused somebody else to do evil things. You know,
yeah.
The people themselves had no willful intent. The king did not mean to become a bad king. Pippin or Merry, because they're the same character, you know, did not intend to become this evil thing. It was the Palantir that made him do it. And it's a gross misunderstanding of human nature. We are evil people. We are good people. You know, everything that is evil and good in the world comes from us. Generally speaking, what we think of as good and evil. And that is just outside of everything that I was taught to understand and believe as a child. And that's why I was taught those things as a child, because you can't possibly believe them when you're older.
Well, yeah, because it's the same idea in Christianity, where it's like there's a devil who's supposed to represent all, you know, all evil and and he's tempting you. And it, yeah, it's a very Catholic outlook. I like novels like in the Sean Stewart books that I just worship, like Resurrection Man and Night Watch. In Night Watch, it's basically a science fiction novel that's an animist magical system where nature wants what nature wants. And it's not good or it's not evil. It just wants things. And the forest loves this one girl, and so it will kill everyone to protect her. And that's just what the forest does. And it's a beautiful, and I responded so much more to those kind of things where it's like the Heinlein rational fantasy novel novella, Magic Inc. You know, where it really appealed to me to treat magic as something that's sort of an economic or just a force out there, and then other people are going to do with it as they will, and that's sort of the same way I feel about religion.
Yeah. Yes.
It's a nice tool. But on the other hand, like anytime I end up writing something that ends up being a critique of a religion, that annoys me too. Like I'm not really into the cynical use of just slamming, you know, people for their beliefs. So there's a short story I have called Damascus, which is basically my take on. I wanted to cover an entire religion from start to finish, but the nicest character in it is this Christian woman who is the last person to sort of offer, you know, mercy. And one thing I've always admired about the culture I came out of is these people know how to do hospitality. They know how to take care of other people. They have a system in place for how to respond during tragedy, and they know how to show up for funerals, and they know how to show up with food when you're hungry. And so I just really admire that while critiquing some of the other stuff, like the fact that, Katrina meant God hates gays or something. You know, yeah. You got to separate out the nonsense from the other stuff.
Yeah. There's Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson. I love that book. Yeah, that's one of my favorite books of all time. He's the main character is leaving his wife.
She writes like a hateful thesis about him.
Yeah.
And breaks up with him. And yeah, go ahead.
And the only people who are able to react to it rationally among his circle of friends are the ones who are secretly Christians. He didn't know that they believed in God until they offered him a place to live for a little while. And there's all this God stuff everywhere, you know. And he's like, oh, well, that's because they have a system in place to understand what's going on between me and my wife right now. They understand that sometimes, you know, evil occurs, and they've got a system in place to deal with it. They do hospitality. They do, you know, charity and all this stuff. Actually, my day job, you know, right now, it's a very strange place for me to work, but I work for a company that does fundraising, primarily for nonprofit organizations, primarily for Christian organizations, and primarily for homeless shelters. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do, I'm awkwardly uncomfortable with, because they send out mailings about, you know, what to do. It sounds horrible. I'm not going to say it, but they do some really the things that I'm like, I don't want to deal with this. But generally speaking, they feed homeless people, and there are a lot of people who don't do that, you know. So it's interesting. It's a very strange culture to work in, and the hours are insane because these people who don't have jobs, they have a mission. So you're like, oh, you know, I want to go home at 5:00. Oh, that's too bad. God wants you to stay till 7.
We have people to feed. Damn it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. Are you hungry? Because we're feeding homeless people here. Holy people. My God. I actually had my boss in a staff meeting say, work is holy. That was his defense for why we were all working 60 hours a week. Because it's holy. That's a terrible reason.
And by the way, I want you to assemble the children. We are going to be marching on Jerusalem later.
Yes, exactly.
I know it kind of sucks, but I think it's something you got to do.
That all started with Process, didn't it?
Sure did.
Yes, it did.
Amazing.
Well, we have been going for about an hour here, so we can wrap it up before we confront too much more of our own awkward silence.
Excellent.
This is the most I've talked to Tim probably that's not been in a crowded, sweaty room at a con, so this is excellent.
True that.
But let's see. So in lieu of, our fairly traditional closing here at the Locust Roundtable podcast is to ask you both what you have either out or coming out, and it sounds like you both have excellent books coming out darn near right about now. So, Daryl, do you want to...
Yep, so that anti-zombie novel, Raising Stony Mayhall, is out at the end of June. And in the fall at World Fantasy, we'll be launching a short story collection called Unpossible and Other Stories. It'll come out from Fairwood Press. And meanwhile, I'm writing Planet of the Apes and finishing up the last few issues of Dracula Company of Monsters for Boom Studios.
And that's Boom with an exclamation point.
Boom in all capitals with an exclamation mark. In Spanish, they actually have the exclamation mark on both sides. When
they translate. There you go.
Nice.
And Tim?
I am less busy than that. I have Dead of Viridon coming out on Tuesday, May 31st, which means it might already be out when this airs. And that is it. I am off contract. I am freely working on another project that I have not sold, which is the first time that's ever happened. Very excited.
Ah, interesting.
See, most people, Tim, start that way. They.
It's very freeing to not have anybody expect a specific thing from you. I have two books I could write tomorrow. I have no idea which one I'm going to write. I'm excited about that.
That's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, well, thank you both very much for coming on.
Thanks,
Karen.